let's sort of start the process. But as ever with LSE events, there'll be a few moments of sort of introductions before we get into the real substance. So a few more people may slip in and join us. But first of all, welcome virtually to the LSE. It's a shame, of course, not to be able to welcome you physically into an LSE building, but there are merits and advantages doing this on Zoom, not least because our speaker, or our main speaker tonight, is joining us from Florence, so he's been saved the complications of travel. So welcome to this event on Hendrik De Man and social democracy. In effect, it's the book launch for Tommaso Milani's important new book on that subject. My name's Piers Ludlow. I'm the head of the International History Department, but I have a further connection in that I was one of two supervisors of Tommaso when he was an excellent PhD student in our department. And I'm delighted to see Professor Heather Jones, now sadly at UCL, or sadly for us, but probably happily for UCL, has also joined us tonight. So Heather and I had the pleasure of supervising Tommaso. But Tommaso has now gone on to become a Max Weber fellow at the European University Institute in Florence, and he will be joining us there from there tonight. We're also very fortunate in having two excellent discussants for tonight's book. What's going to happen is Tommaso will give a 20-25 minute talk about some of the major themes of the book. And then we will have comments by two very well qualified experts in the field. The first of whom is my colleague, Dr. Guzenova, Dina Guzenova, who is at the LSE, who works generally on interwar Europe, but has touched upon many of the themes of the book itself in her own research. And so she will be giving a sort of contextualizing some of Tommaso's ideas and responding to them. And then we will be joined as a second discussant by my friend and colleague, Martin Conway, Professor of History in Oxford at Balliol. And he will be talking to some extent about the legacy of De Man. Martin has a particular interest and expertise in all things Belgian. And of course, De Man is one of that exclusive category, a famous Belgian. So we have that makes him a particularly appropriate and qualified commentator. I will limit my role to a few brief introductions and one or two sort of housekeeping events, the most important of which is to remind you that tonight's proceedings are being recorded. So that includes the Q&A, so just so that you're aware of that. And can I also ask that when not speaking, people mute themselves? I should also announce that the book that we're launching is going to be available at a extremely advantageous discounted price, and a link to get hold of the book in its electronic form, at least at this discounted price, will be posted in the chat in the course of the lecture. So those of you wishing to snap up a bargain may want to visit the chat for that reason. The chat is also a good way when we get to the Q&A of signalling that you want to intervene. Okay, but without much further ado, I will hand over to Tommaso and give you the floor. Tommaso.
Okay, so I hope you can now see my slides. Okay. Okay. Perfect. So thank you, Piers, for your kind words of introduction. Thank you, Dina and Martin, for agreeing to be part of this. And thank you to everyone in the audience. It's a huge pleasure and privilege to be back via Zoom to the place where I completed my PhD in 2017. So let me express my gratitude to the LSE International History Department for the invitation and for having set up this online event so efficiently. My intention is to deliver a relatively concise presentation, as I'm sure we will have a lively and thought-provoking discussion afterwards. Because of this, I will not rush into summarizing the findings of the book. Instead, I will give a few snapshots of Hendrik de Man's life to the benefit of those among you who may be unfamiliar with it. Then I will suggest three angles from which his trajectory can be studied and my book read. By doing so, I hope to further stimulate your interest in my work. And obviously, if you would like me to expand on any of the issues I will mention, please do not hesitate to ask during the Q&A. Hendrik, or Henri, if you prefer the French form, de Man, was born in Antwerp in 1885 into a Flemish, stern upper-class family with whom he broke off relations at the turn of the century due to his burgeoning left-wing radicalism that caused his expulsion from a prestigious college and brought him to Leipzig, where young Hendrik converted to untainted German Marxism in a mood that, in retrospect, he would describe as frenzied. A notorious troublemaker, he clashed with the establishment of the Belgian Labour Party, PLB, of which he was a card-carrying member, over the leadership's nonchalant pragmatism and, in his view, inadequate ideological ballast. De Man's unreserved admiration for German socialism, however, did not outlive the July crisis. Having been a first-hand witness of the Second International's failure to stop the escalation of summer 1914, he joined his national army as soon as Belgium was attacked. His decision to volunteer, in spite of his pacifist convictions and passion for German culture, kicked off a process of psychological, moral, and intellectual departure from Orthodox Marxism he would later detail in a 1919 book written in English, The Remaking of a Mind, A Soldier's Thoughts on War and Reconstruction. Crucially, the conflict allowed the man not only to be exposed to trench warfare, but also to travel as an envoy to Russia after the 1917 February Revolution and to the United States. These journeys emboldened his anti-Bolshevism, made him oddly pro-American, and persuaded him of the importance of a liberal democratic institutional setting for socialism to flourish. Neither a die-hard revolutionary nor a cautious reformist, the man moved back to Germany in the 1920s to teach courses in social psychology at Darmstadt and Frankfurt. There, he articulated an all-out critique of Orthodox Marxism in Zur Psychologie des Sozialismus, a long, dense book first published in 1926, better known under the title of the French edition, Au-delà du Marxisme. Harshly reviewed by his former mentor Kautsky, Emil van der Velde, and other senior theorists, the book made quite a splash by denouncing a crisis of imagination and a strategic impasse within socialism. His bold diagnosis struck a chord with younger militants, André Philippe, Carlo Rosselli, Hendrik Brugmans, to name a few, who were longing for new theories more compatible with their outlook, principles, and values. Only in the context of the Great Depression, however, de Man mastered enough support to be appointed vice president of the PLB in December 1933, thus having a real chance to reshape the party's line and inner functioning. By then, the man had a clear message that resonated with the rank and file. The democratic left, in order not to be wiped out by the far right, was to reconnect with the working class by championing a full-blooded, aggressively interventionist set of state-sanctioned measures aimed at fighting unemployment, including the nationalization of key industries and a much tighter control over finance. This should not be confused with Soviet-style collectivization. The mixed economy outlined in the labor plan that the man hammered out on behalf of the POB after having returned to Brussels argued for the coexistence of a public and a private sector through a multi-layered structure with planners in charge of streamlining and coordinating both. This somewhat visionary system was intended to deliberately carve out spaces for free competition among producers while ensuring a high level of economic security, stability, and efficiency, in sharp contrast to the obsolete, deflationist, reactionary variant of capitalism that the man believed was painfully dragging on across Western Europe. And yet, the man's achievements as politician did not live up to the high expectations raised by his meteoric rise. Having masterminded an innovative, dynamic campaign for the labor plan between 1933 and 1935, which added to his prestige at home and abroad, the man went on to serve in three national governments under Prime Ministers Paul van Zeeland and later Paul-Émile Janson from March 1935 till March 1938, initially as Minister of Public Works and then as Minister of Finance. All in all, his underwhelming tenure, characterized by increasingly strained relationships with his party, coalition partners, and Belgian bankers, not only damaged his credibility, but also undermined his trust in parliamentary rule. This mounting disillusionment was to have far-reaching consequences during the Second World War. Following the military defeat and surrender of late May 1940, the man, then president of the POB, but closer to the Belgian king than to the majority of his own party, issued a manifesto urging militants to collaborate with the Germans on the grounds that, and I quote, far from being a disaster, the collapse of a decrepit world would turn into a deliverance for the working classes and for socialism, end of quote. From that moment on, the man's reputation plummeted as charges of treason and disloyalty made by former comrades in exile soon overshadowed his once towering status. Having become a fairly marginal and dispensable player during the occupation, at least since mid-1941, the man eventually fled to France and then to Switzerland, where he died in 1953, 7 years after having been convicted in absentia. At this stage, to avoid any possible misunderstanding, I must clarify that my book is less a biography of the man than a study of the man's impact on Western European social democracy, which I define as the non-communist, non-anarchist left encompassing political parties as well as trade unions from the outbreak of World War I to the beginning of the Nazi occupation of Belgium. Between 1914 and 1940, not only the man's influence on the movement he belonged to reached its peak, but also his actual allegiance to democratic socialism went largely unquestioned by his supporters and opponents alike. If the man left a substantial, albeit controversial, mark on social democracy, the reverse is equally true. The man's ideas and actions make little sense if taken out of the social democratic milieu and treated in isolation from the inner tensions and troubles social democracy went through during his lifetime. This is why I suggest that the first angle from which the man's story can be examined is that of the fraying of Orthodox Marxism as a broadly coherent ideology, ensuring some degree of cohesion between the various strands of socialist thought that had proliferated across Western Europe. Obviously, the man did not provoke that crisis. Well, before him, prominent dissidents such as Edward Bernstein and Georges Sorel had gone to great lengths to prove that Marxism was not a perfect fit for socialism. And many unforeseen events and trends at work in the second half of the 19th century had already cast doubts on the soundness of the theoretical framework that distinguished theorists as Friedrich Engels and Karl Kautsky had assembled. However, it remains that much of what the man wrote and stood for was aimed at challenging the mechanistic, deterministic, and materialistic foundations of Orthodox Marxism in an original and provocative way. My book investigates the man's prolonged and consistent efforts to renew the culture, key tenets, and purposes of socialism by putting conscious human will at the core of his thinking. Drawing on insights from new disciplines, most notably social psychology, as well as on a variety of intellectual and practical experiences he had considerable knowledge of. From US scientific management to British guild socialism, from debates between German Jungsozialisten to French blueprints for l'économie dirigée. To be sure, the man's eclecticism was not without its downsides. More specifically, as my book underscores, his penchant for welding heterogeneous ideas into fresh synthesis earned him the hostility of more orthodox ideologues who deeply resented his tendency to move into uncharted waters, and his disdain for the doctrinal legacy of previous generations. On the other hand, these traits of the man's personality bolstered his standing in the eyes of those militants who could no longer swallow the apparent inertia and lack of creativity of the aging social democratic elite. The second angle from which the man's story can be approached is that of his intermittent political activism. Its roots can be traced back to his short-lived militancy on the far-left fringe of the POB before 1914, but its sudden resumption was arguably triggered by the decline and downfall of the Weimar Republic, which he witnessed and extensively commented on. My book points out that the man's resolve to devise a set of policies capable of halting the rise of fascism loomed large in his decision to go into politics in mid-1933. Yet, in terms of engagement broadly defined, the man never completely ceased to be active, even when he prioritized his intellectual pursuits. As my monograph shows, through his writings, he managed to reach out to and connect with key sections of the Western European social democratic youth, laying the groundwork for the transnational network underpinning the planist movement he attempted to build throughout the 1930s. By the same token, his fascination with economic planning, far from being limited to the conceptual sphere, was informed by an acute awareness of the emotional appeal that the notion of plan could have in an age of social and economic upheaval. From the man's perspective, the Labour plan was never meant to provide purely technocratic solutions to the structural deficiencies of capitalism. Rather, he viewed it as an instrument to mobilize ordinary citizens, rekindling the fighting spirit of industrial workers and of the unemployed, while at the same time winning over artisans, shopkeepers, small entrepreneurs, and other middle-class elements hard hit by the Great Depression. For this reason, my book pays close attention to the man's role as a political operator before and after his entry into government, as well as to the repercussions of his actions over other social democratic parties and trade unions outside Belgium. Two chapters deal specifically with France and Britain, and references to other national experiences are also featured. This is important because, as I try to demonstrate, a comprehensive analysis of the man's influence on social democracy must go well beyond the scrutiny of the man as an individual and of his inner circle, covering cases of selective reception and even disingenuous appropriation of his ideas, tactics, and strategy. The third angle from which the man's story can be tackled is that of his evolving views on liberal democracy, or, to be more accurate, the peculiar form of government that gradually emerged across Western Europe throughout the 19th century, marked by the centrality of parliament, the separation of powers, the rule of law, free and competitive elections, and the safeguard of civil liberties. In the aftermath of the First World War, the man came to embrace this system wholeheartedly, maintaining that representative institutions, whatever their flaws, provided suitable tools for overhauling and, in due course, transcending the capitalist structures that were embedding them. More generally, the man's staunch anti-communism drew strength from a wider commitment to political, societal, and economic pluralism, making him wary of centralization and bureaucratization, even when his planism led him to advocate a bigger state and a stronger executive branch in implementing major reforms. Nevertheless, the almost juvenile enthusiasm for liberal democracy expressed by the man in the 1920s, also reflecting his high opinion of the Westminster model and of the British Labour Party's capacity to make strides into it, vanished in the second half of the 30s, as the predicament he faced as party grandee and minister left him disenchanted with many of the institutions whose virtues he had previously extolled. In the book, I contend that the man's call for a more authoritarian model of democracy, and then, after the capitulation of 1940, his faithful endorsement of a fully-fledged autocratic corporatist monarchy was less the result of a linear theoretical evolution than the fallout of his frustrating political career, which eroded his faith in liberal democracy's ability to bring about radical change. Having once hailed, in a quasi-Tocquevillian fashion, constitutional checks and balances as essential to prevent despotism, the man reached the dismal conclusion that special interest groups were taking advantage of those provisions way too easily, up to the point of making a mockery of the popular will, and that liberal democracy was overall too unsteady, too enfeebled, and most important of all, too entangled with the corporate world to crack down on big business. Like Franklin Roosevelt, the man had become convinced, to quote one of FDR's most famous 1936 campaign speeches, that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob. But unlike Roosevelt, he was ultimately unable to retain confidence in liberal democracy's capacity to rein in financial monopolies and meet the daunting challenges it was confronting. It must be stressed that this unrelenting pessimism was exacerbated by the man's brazen self-confidence and unbridled ambition. An intellectual with no legislative track record, no parliamentary constituency, and no patience with the unwritten rules of Belgian public life, he repeatedly miscalculated about the possibility of forcing his agenda through his party, let alone his country as a whole. Still, his gloomy attitude may also be viewed as a symptom of a deeper and more widespread malaise quite common in the late 1930s. When European democracies too often muddled, half-hearted responses to the Depression paled in comparison to the seemingly stunning accomplishments of totalitarian regimes. To conclude, I hope this overview has offered a few glimpses of what readers can find in my book. This is the story of a man, a soldier, a diplomat, a thinker, a party leader, a minister, and later an outcast. But it's also the story of a mass movement, of profound ideological shifts, of new buzzwords that were launched, of forms of propaganda and campaign techniques that were pioneered, of alliances, bonds, and rivalries forged in the crucible of interwar Europe. It is the story of a collective endeavor to contest but also revive democracy, of a failure to achieve transformative goals, and of the bitterness prompted by a head-on collision with the realities of power. Whether, as I venture to speculate in the conclusions of my monograph, the man's rocky relationship with social democracy was riddled with missed opportunities remains an open question. Surely, the man's trajectory sheds much light on the difficulties the Western European left grappled with in the first half of the 20th century and beyond. I'll stop here. Thank you very much for your attention.
Many thanks, Tommaso, for an excellent introduction to some of the key ideas in your book. It brings back strong memories of some of our earlier discussions. But I want to hand matters straight over to our first discussant. So, Dina, can I give you the floor?
Yes, thanks very much, Piers. And thank you, Tommaso, for inviting me to this this wonderful event. I'm extremely pleased. And I must say, I'm kind of vicariously enjoying the success of your project. So congratulations on this, because I remember as a PhD student, I was once told that one should never work on feeble thinkers. And by feeble thinkers, this person meant, you know, people with unstable intellectual identities, basically, because this will not allow you to explore a big subject. And I think you've proven with this book that that actually quite the opposite is the case, that often the work on these big figures, these familiar and oriented sort of and rooted characters do not actually provide us with new insights and new understandings of the past. So in my brief comments, I would like to share with the others maybe the kind of intervention that the very design in the sense of the book, of this project as I see it, actually does to a history of Western European socialism, perhaps the left more generally. So I will begin with this kind of faux pas in book discussions, which is a discussion of what the book is not. But just very briefly, I want to say that often the history of interwar socialism, kind of rather similar to the history of Weimar culture more broadly, is told in the mode of an ancient Greek tragedy. So socialism of the Second International is its main protagonist. In a sort of Aristotelian fashion, the action begins with the introduction of the First World War, a middle part with the partial success of the socialist parties rising to their establishment in the European parliaments, and eventually their downfall, more or less in the context of the rise of the Nazis. And this kind of tragedy also calls for a specific setting, and often the setting is the big major countries with major socialist parties, so France and Germany. And then if you wanted to look at particular figures, then of course these figures will be Kautsky, the so-called Pope of German social democracy, and then it will be, in the absence of Jaurès, who of course was assassinated in 1914, it will be Léon Blum for France and the Popular Front. And then the idea is that, in a sense, the end of this particular version of socialism, its collapse, and ultimately it's the return in a very different guise after the Second World War, so the kind of retreat of socialism from working class interests and from this idea of challenging the state to a kind of accommodationist sort of role with the state, that is kind of the result of a sort of catharsis for the reader, that the reader experiences the sort of decline of this phenomenon in the Second World War, its demise as a sort of end, the catharsis, which then enables this new chapter to start, the world in which we live today. I mean, there's some, you know, there's still some plausibility to some of the story, I think, but I also think it's really important to challenge these kind of patterns that that I think many of us have come to inhabit. And Tommaso's book constitutes a profound challenge, not only through his choice of this difficult protagonist who kind of evolves and publicly displays, in a sense, the evolution of his thought, this progressive alienation of in his thinking from Marxism, but also just because of the kinds of analytical questions that he keeps asking in this book. By picking De Man, he introduces not only a former kind of intellectual star with an tainted kind of character, so something that an Aristotelian protagonist could never really have, the tainted quality coming from his kind of collaborationist moment, if you like, from 1940, when you know Belgium is occupied, but also because of the kind of temporal development of his fortunes. I mean, the great impact of De Man really starts around the late 20s and reaches its pinnacle really around the year 1933, 1934, which is the point when Europe kind of plunges into darkness. So it really challenges our familiar sort of periodization of the entire period. At the same time, Milani does not throw overboard the kind of tragic story of socialism we all know, partly because De Man himself, as a historian of socialism, in his book and in this book that Tommaso just mentioned, in the reflections on his experiences of the war and also later in the 20s, he himself is kind of partial to this tragic vision, and he talks a lot about the assassination of Jaurès and sort of the collapse of the Second International, and is obviously part of that movement. But the story of Western socialism that we end up with following De Man's thinking is much more ambivalent and much more complex. And also we end up, in a sense, as a reader, changing our mind, in a sense, from starting with thinking about De Man as this kind of slightly murky sort of person who eventually ends up in the fascist camp, to actually somebody who looks much more like John Maynard Keynes or Roosevelt, or I don't know, in today's discussions, perhaps Biden or something. So I don't want to kind of make it a bit too anachronistic, but I just want to throw this in there as a possible discussion point. So I think this is a very, very, very interesting topic for me. And for my own research, I found that this provided an extremely welcome, actually kind of explanation of this puzzling character. I must admit, I've always kind of avoided engaging with De Man. I've encountered him in the context of Weimar culture and the sort of various drifting figures that were kind of exploring different ideas of society. And they included people like the kind of rather bizarre Count Hermann Kaiserling, who wrote a glowing review of De Man's Psychology of Socialism. which is really bizarre because he himself was certainly not a socialist, but he was a kind of existentialist thinker, an uprooted Baltic baron who really empathized with a kind of very different type of uprootedness that ultimately de Man displayed in displaying his kind of alienation from socialism. And from this period of his life, and this is a quote that Tomaso also brings, de Man suggested in 1919, in fact, de Man quoted an essay by Robert Louis Stevenson in which, Victorian kind of thinking about human character, in which he states, so this is Stevenson quoted by de Man in 1919. When the torrent sweeps the man against the boulder, you must expect him to scream, and you need not be surprised if the scream is sometimes a theory. So what I found really interesting is that the theory, which comes out from de Man's kind of long scream that lasts throughout the kind of 1920s, that theory is ultimately the kind of socialism that many of the socialist parties today seem to be kind of dealing with. In a sense, and that de Man, in a sense, contradicted his own original motto, which was initially a kind of major disappointment with Bolshevik versions of Marxism. And at the time he had said, I quote de Man, "If I had to choose, I would prefer living in a democracy without socialism than under a socialist regime without democracy." Now, in the end, ironically, de Man flourished under a regime that was neither socialist nor democratic, but in a sense, of course, in the end, actually, the vision he left behind did shape a lot of the many directions of socialist democracies. I realized I don't have maybe a couple of minutes left, so I just want to leave you with a sort of conclusion that I was left with from reading Tomaso's book. And again, I want to return to this idea of if we retreat from this Greek tragedy image of socialism, what are we left with? We're left with a kind of modern tragedy, partly a kind of existentialist story, a kind of Celine type figure. So instead of these established socialists like Kautsky, van der Velde, or Blum, who really had to stick to they had a kind of theoretical attachment, as Tomaso concludes at the end, to Marxism, and were ultimately not able to retreat from this attachment in the light of the experiences of wartime mobilization, American capitalism, and such phenomena. De Man showed a remarkable capacity of adaptation at the risk of his kind of reputational change. And that sort of change is what a complex and modern type of tragedy might call a kind of reversal of fortune. So not a change of fortune like in the classical tragedy, but a reversal of fortune. So, and at the end of this book, I had to ask myself, must we come to terms with the fact that this too was socialism or is socialism? And what are the implications of the story for modern day understandings of what it means to be progressive? In other words, how much is being a progressive actually an accident of one's geopolitical location or even birth, rather than the product of any kind of essential characteristic, commitment to theory, or an admirable practical activity? So I will just leave my comments at that and look forward to the discussion. Congratulations, Tomaso, and thanks again.
Thank you, Dina. I think the idea of theory as scream will be one that I will probably return to when listening to occasional IR lectures, etc. But I will not dwell on that point. Martin, let me hand over the floor to you.
Thank you very much, Piers, and thank you, Tomaso, for giving us this splendid book. I think my comments pick up really where Dina just left off, actually. Nobody loves a failure except for historians. They really love failures, you know. And what's really interesting about de Man is the way in which he fails. This is not the failure of a sort of man of principle who's done down by imperfect entourage and by an uncaring world. You know, this is not some heroic man of principle. This is actually somebody who has Tomaso very well displayed this afternoon, you know, actually changes his views on almost everything quite regularly, but somehow doesn't manage ever to get on the train of success. He always does it in the wrong way, at the wrong time and in the wrong spirit, and pisses off somebody, excuse my language, when, you know, who he should have been chatting up. So he finds himself always left somewhere behind the pace of political events. And that's quite an interesting psychological phenomenon, but also kind of an important political phenomenon. That's where I think my comments would converge with those of Dina. Because what one sees here is somebody who always seems to find himself slightly on the wrong side of history or on the wrong side of events. And one's left instead with this sort of monument to a particular sort of early mid 20th century masculinity. Because the best thing about de Man is the pictures you've seen this evening. Note the mountain climbing in a flat country. Note the very good taste in suits. And note that interesting facial hair, one of the more famous moustaches of the 20th century, to put perhaps alongside Ataturk's. And above all, of course, the pipes. You know, this is his real contribution to the 20th century and to socialism. Confronted by the broader failures of his life, one takes refuge in those sort of features of de Man. And what I want to talk through in the next few minutes, probably, is what I feel are the three interesting failures of de Man's political career. They are about his involvement with the Socialist Party in Belgium, about his activities during the war, and about his attitude towards social democracy. The first, then, is his mistake, his failure to understand the nature of the POB, the Belgian Socialist Party, the interwar years. A very powerful party that in many ways it looks destined to become the principal governing party of Belgium in the 20th century, but consistently loses out to the Catholic Party in terms of real kind of street level political opportunism. No comparison, of course, with the Tory party nowadays. The issue of the POB is that de Man wants to make it a vehicle towards power. He's read things like Blum's distinction between mere occupation of power and the exercise of power and the conquest of power, and he's agreed with it. And he wants to take the POB in the 1930s from being an occupier of power to being something that's exercising power and somewhere slightly over the horizon, conquering power. And what he doesn't realize is that most of his colleagues in the POB are horrified by this prospect. I simplify a little, but there's not actually a desire for the exercise of executive power within much of the POB within the 1930s. And it's typified, of course, by the attitude of Van der Velde. Instead, they want to occupy power. They want to occupy power at every level, governmental power, local power, social power. And they want to be able to block some of their obvious opponents, most obviously the communists, from getting more of a hold of power. But they're not really interested in what de Man has written in his plan. And so when de Man finds himself rather accidentally sort of trampolined really into a position of power as the finance minister in the Van Zeelen government and subsequently in the Janson government, he finds that suddenly nobody is left around him. He's left on his own in that role. And of course, as we'd always slightly suspected about de Man, he wasn't actually that good at adding up or about thinking about complicated issues of public finance. And he actually has a fairly catastrophic time as finance minister. And if anybody's interested in this, there's a splendid thesis just been defended in Brussels by Simon Wettin that shows just what a bad finance minister de Man was in the mid-30s, who runs up a huge deficit, not because of some, you know, bold sort of counter-cyclical Keynesian policy, but just because he got some of the sums wrong. So there's a sense that actually de Man has misunderstood the purpose of the POB. It's not there to conquer power or still less to carry out socialist revolution. It's there to be a vehicle for the defense of the interests of the people it represents, most obviously in its own mind, the industrial working class of Belgium. So that's his first failure. And of course, it leaves him slightly out in the cold. The second failure is to believe his belief that parliamentary democracy had somehow come to an end at the end of the 1930s, and that the events, the military events of the early war years, were somehow not just military events, but ideological, political, earth-changing, century-changing watersheds by which Europe was finally exiting from a century or so of rather corrupt, ineffectual parliamentary rule since 1848, and was going to enter into a new era of efficient technocratic authoritarian government. You can throw the adjectives around in any order you wish, but that's what he's trying to climb onto. And of course, his second failure is the fact that he doesn't recognize that much of this is actually contingent on a certain sort of geopolitical configuration in Europe, in which, by various accidents of circumstance, the Third Reich has acquired a rather transient ascendancy. He's not, of course, wrong, and not alone in making this sort of error. As Tommaso said this evening, you know, the most obvious person who makes that error is the King of the Belgians, Leopold III, standing next to him in one of the pictures Tommaso showed us this evening. And de Man, having alienated so much of the Socialist Party, essentially forges a rather personal alliance with Leopold III and with the clique around Leopold III, who talk very confidently about the new order that they are going to bring about in a German-occupied Belgium, because they haven't, and de Man in particular, haven't realised that the Germans aren't interested in that sort of deal. The idea of some comprehensive political settlement in a German-conquered Europe is something that seems to actually terrify the political elite of the Third Reich, because they don't quite know what on earth that would look like, and in a particular parochial Belgian context, whether there should even be a place called Belgium, or whether you should be breaking it up into its constituent racial or ethnic elements. So de Man is chasing a chimera here. He's chasing an idea that there's going to be some sort of earth-changing political settlement in Europe. And of course, it evaporates over the winter of 1940 into 1941, leaving de Man stuck advocating something that's no longer a political choice. And you can read about this very well in his biography, is it? Well, his sort of justification of himself that he writes at this time, called Après Coup, which demonstrates the most consistent psychological trait of de Man, which is that he never admits that at any point he was wrong. That book is dominated by the idea he was right at every time, but somehow everything ended up going wrong. He was never an emphatic pro-German collaborator. He was somebody who always thought in much bigger terms and was thinking about this new political settlement that would emerge, and which had almost evaporated almost before he'd thought of it. His third failure across his political career is the one that also extends beyond his relatively premature death, which is failure to see social democracy coming. By which I don't mean more generally social democracy, but I mean the specific form of social democracy that began to take shape in primarily Western Europe from the sort of about 1947, I suppose, to something like the Bad Godesberg Conference at the end of the 1950s into the early 1960s. This is, without doubt, the most interesting formative period in the evolution of socialism across the 20th century in Western Europe. And de Man didn't really understand anything about it. Of course, he's not alone in that. Nobody had particularly seen it coming. And one of the most interesting features of much of the recent work that's been done on socialism in Europe in the 1930s is how very little of the socialism of that decade seems to be in any realistic way a precursor of this sort of social democracy that would emerge after the Second World War. One sees that very well in Ian Stewart's recent intellectual biography of Raymond Aron, who calls himself a socialist in the 1930s, thinks of himself as a socialist in the 1930s, but he's clearly completely opposed to this sort of social democracy that emerges after the Second World War. It's a bit, writing the history of the path into that sort of social democracy, it seems like a bit of a fool's game, really. It's where you suddenly have to, if you're playing with the children on the floor with the train set, you have to try to make the train engine jump across a gap in the rails, where the rails go somewhere, and then you have to get the train to fly in the air and to land on the track on the other side. It's that sort of jump cut worthy of Godard, which happens in so much of socialist thought across the late 1930s into the 1940s. And, well, yes, de Man failed to make the jump, didn't he? He didn't land on the tracks on the other side. It required courage, it required timing, but it certainly could be done, because somebody who in many ways had less political, had less intellectual power than him, with much greater political skill, Paul-Henri Spaak, did it incredibly well in Belgium and more generally across Europe in this period, enabling to arrive on the other side as some sort of architect of the new Europe, as the architect of the Secretary General of NATO, Socialist Prime Minister of Belgium after the war and so on. These are all things which de Man was denied by his lack of courage and timing. And by the sense that he remained rooted in this utter dislike, this contempt in many ways for the structures of parliamentary democracy. And I love the letter that Tommaso cites in his book that de Man wrote privately in January 1949, where he says, "The greatest fault of this last generation of socialists has been to mistake democracy for the parliamentary regime." Well, I know Switzerland always has a feeling of being slightly out of time, but to write that in 1949, have you not seen what's been happening, Henrik, to socialism over the previous 5 years? It's been embracing the parliamentary regime, as he terms it, with such emphasis and enthusiasm. We may criticize that enthusiasm, but that is at it. That is where socialism has landed once it's jumped over the war years. And it's taken with it some of the language of planning, which de Man claimed to espouse. It may be planning within much more a liberal capitalist regime than had been the case before the war, but it's about a historic reconciliation of that vision of socialist order with parliamentary democracy. And de Man has not made the leap, and he's been left on the other side as this sort of relic of particular currents of socialism of the interwar years. And so he ends up being this consistent failure, whose death in that respect is rather fortunate, because it's very difficult to quite imagine where he would have gone over the next 10 years. And instead of being, you know, the greatest socialist pipe smoker of the 20th century, he has to hand that label on to Harold Wilson. And that really is the proof of failure. Thank you very much.
I think that ending is going to take some beating. Well, many thanks, Martin, for some excellent and insightful comments. I'm aware just by looking at the names on the screen, that there are a lot of people in our virtual audience who know much more about both interwar Europe and socialism than I do. So I suspect it's probably best if I sort of open the floor immediately to questions rather than venturing any myself. If you can indicate that you want to intervene by using the sort of raised hand symbol. I see that a couple of you have already got in there with questions. And can I ask you to keep your questions brief and unmute yourself, obviously, when you're called upon, and then remute yourself afterwards. The first hand I saw was David Klemperer. So can I hand over the floor to you?
Hi, thank you, Tommaso, and thank you all the other speakers. I just wondered if I could push Tommaso a little bit on this issue that Martin raised of post-war social democracy. At the end of your book, you're very cautious in the claims you make about the influence of planism in the development of social democracy. I wondered if you could set out for us here just a little bit more about how you see planism as having influenced or not influenced the development of post-war social democracy.
Tommaso, do you want to take that straight away? I think probably rather than grouping questions, let's do them one by one to begin with.
That's fine. Oh, thank you. Thank you to both discussants for wonderful comments and remarks. And I will touch upon some of the issues they have raised in my replies to the questions. In terms of long-term influence, well, yeah, in a sense, I am cautious because I am unconvinced that a straight line can be drawn between the man's ideas or policy proposals and post-war social democracy. Partly because of what Martin Riley pointed out is lack of understanding and also lack of passion and genuine intellectual interest for what was happening, but also because of the significant differences between the type of political system that post-war social democrats endorsed, most notably parliamentary democracy, and the great emphasis on a strong executive that the man championed throughout the 1930s. He was not very much interested in social democracy, practicing power sharing and grand coalitions with other parties. Ideally, he wanted social democracy to become a majority party by absorbing voters from other classes beyond industrial workers. And again, this is one of the great differences, by the way, between SPAC and the man, in my view. SPAC had a much better sense that if you have to cooperate with the Catholics, it doesn't really make sense to try to steal votes from the Catholic Party, whereas the man had a much more competitive view of the pale-based relationship with other groupings. And also from a wider perspective, because again, the man always put, you know, the emphasis on like energetic actions, big policy proposals to be introduced rather than piecemeal reforms that could be passed. But yet this kind of grandiose view of politics as a way to conquer power and use it in order to transform society. And how could he possibly like the type of socialism that post-war parties were preaching, which was largely aimed at reassuring voters that they were not too radical, too ambitious, too extreme? Think about the Labour Party presenting itself as the good housekeeping party. You know, this kind of argument could not resonate with him at all. This is not to say that he didn't have any influence. I think on one particular issue throughout my research, the man really had some real impact. Social democracy as a movement in the 1930s was still dominated by figures who were surprisingly hostile to the idea of using the state in order to radically transform society, and were also very, you know, suspicious of the notion of a mixed economy. The idea of having a private sector on the one end, the public sector on the other, and that these could two sectors could be balanced somehow. The man makes this theoretical argument very clearly and brings it to the fore in a time in which this was not the dominant view. And I think this might have influenced some of his followers who went on to play top roles in post-war politics, who came from this kind of intellectual background. So I believe we can trace some influences, but at the same time, I would say post-war social democracy was absolutely not planism in disguise.
Thank you. The second person yellow hand I spotted was Ettore Costa.
Thank you. Congratulations, Tommaso, for your work. Great presentation. So I have some small comments. First, about the whether do you think there was a conscious or unconscious covering the tracks of the man in the post-war social democracy? Because when the Socialist International was deciding what to put in their declaration of principle after the war, I think Marinus van der Goes van Natters from the Dutch Labour Party was the only one who quoted the man as one of his models, but he also added, now we held him in contempt and for good reasons. But on the other end, I think I agree with Professor Conway that there was a mixed record of the man, that some of this, some of what he proposed is clearly does not see the reconciliation with liberal democracy. His important legacy is the idea of meeting the middle class and to turning the socialism more on an ethical way and reconciling with the role of the state. But whether do you think there was, the question is just whether you think after the war there was a tendency to consciously or unconsciously cover the tracks of the man legacy. Another thing I wanted to ask you, because I think you also treat it in your research, why do you think that people like the man and they are started with similar position and ended in similar position, although I mean, even the harshest critics of the man would not say that he ended as bad as they are. But so, yes, what pushed them in similar directions? Thank you.
Tommaso, again, I think if you can take that straight away, okay. Then we've got some other questions lined up afterwards.
Perfect. Well, in terms of legacy and memory, yes, absolutely. I mean, in Belgium in particular, the memory was, you know, almost entirely erased from the pale-based institutional history until the 1970s. But if one has a chance to have a look at the celebrations in 1960 that the POB put in place with this huge congress with big faces of founders and great leaders featuring on the wall in a kind of strangely Orwellian fashion, the man is not there, obviously. And you can see this in the way history has been written and rewritten within the Belgian Labour Party. More broadly, yes, this applies also to Western European socialism in general. Very often the man's story was told as a cautionary tale. This is what happens when you, in a sense, go astray and you start combining heterodox ideas without knowing exactly what you're doing. You end up playing into the hands of the enemies of socialism. And this remained true for a very long time. And then I think, you know, at least in the Belgian context, the situation began to change around the late 60s, early 1970s, when also the man's works were republished and discussed from, you know, a less, you know, partisan, if you like, perspective. There are the man similar experiences. Well, of course, there would be a lot to cover in order to provide a satisfactory answer. But I believe there is certainly one major factor that must be cited here, and it's the process of alienation that this figure experienced and felt through the 30s. They are at some point generally hoped and probably could have become a leader of French socialism. If one believes what Jules Mock says in his conversations with Léon Blum, that seemed to be on the cards. But Blum definitely mistrusted him. He disliked him personally, not just ideologically. And when essentially was kicked out of forced to leave the main French Socialist Party, then, you know, in a sense, his career began to drift and collapsed. And again, a bit like the man, even though there were substantial differences, of course, in the positions and also in the social standing of the two. At the outbreak of the war, there was a marginal, peripheral, and almost irrelevant political figure who had failed to develop its own political party. So I would say this process of alienation, this process of political marginalization that scholars like Philippe Bohun, but also others have stressed to explain a certain tendency to break with socialism, or at least to break with the institutional parties that were representing socialism in the late 1930s is important.
Thank you. The next person I spotted was Sara Lorenzini. So, Sara.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Thank you very much. So good to see you all. Thank you, Tommaso, for the great presentation and for your book. I promise I will read soon, but I haven't. So here, two questions. I haven't yet. So here are two questions that go more along the line of what I believe she's called Dina said. So what is missing there? And what I felt was... not missing because the whole presentation made a lot of sense, but from the picture that I have in mind when thinking about the history of planning, the history and history of Europe more in general, and the two questions are very, very short. First question: do colonies feature in demands of thinking and how? Second question: do women feature in demands of thinking and how? Thank you so much. Short question, but with possibly long answers.
Exactly.
You're absolutely right, Sarah. Very, very big issues indeed. Communism, well, definitely. I think it's important. The man published, pieces and one brochure in particular, focusing mostly on the relationship with, communism as an organized force. But if one looks at his wartime experiences in particular, it's pretty clear that the impression he got from the February Revolution and his trip to Russia was quite important in shaping both a deep distrust towards communism and communists in particular, as well as the basic persuasion that the Soviet model, in a way, was inapplicable to Western Europe. And again, he was not the only one, of course, within the socialist camp at that time, arguing along those lines. Kautsky himself makes a perfectly clear argument about this, about the impossibility of transferring the Soviet experiment to Western Europe. And I think this remains an important element to understand the attitude of the man towards communism in the 1930s. Again, deep distrust, the sense that, of course, what was happening in the Soviet Union had to be studied and to be properly understood, but could not be replicated, could not provide a blueprint for the types of challenging that the Western European countries were facing at the time. Fascinating question about women. Very marginal indeed, I would say. This maybe relates to what Martin said about the man's masculinity and also, in a sense, cult of masculinity. But again, I must also add, to be honest, that this was fairly common in the kind of debates that were taking place within the POB at the time. This was a very male-dominated environment, voicing very, very male concerns. The understanding of industrial relations, for example, was clearly based on a certain view of, gender relations that were not clearly spelled out, were not part of the debate, but were certainly very important in informing also the type of policy that the POB was going to promote. This, I mean, and the same applies. The same applies to the wider debate, the way in which the man's ideas were received and criticized by his opponents, reflected the same engendered assumptions about politics that were so common in the 1930s. That dimension is there, but is not there in terms of ideas, in terms of vision, in terms of, constructive ways of dealing with gender issues, but it's there in a way as an overarching cultural framework within which all these debates take place. And interestingly enough, during the campaign for the labor plan, well, I'm happy to say there were a couple of, meetings in which the position of women were supposed to be discussed. But again, the idea was not how the plan was going to influence or improve the condition of women. It was how women could contribute to the, to the carrying out, the implementation and the successful battle for the plan. So I think this asymmetry in a way reflects the state of the art of the period we are talking about.
Thank you. The next question I spotted was from, or next hand I spotted was from Cesare Vaggi. So can I hand the floor to you?
Yes, thank you very much, Tommaso, and thank you very much to all for organizing this very interesting lecture. I have two very brief questions, which quite relate to the current study of French and Italian economic planning in the mid-20th century, which I am currently carrying out under the supervision of Professor Martin Conway. So the first question concerns the French followers of Henri de Mande. And what is interesting about them is that in 1940, they split up. Some of them eventually go work for the Vichy regime, and one of them, René Bellin, becomes the first minister of industrial production in Vichy. And then others, such as Georges Bory and André Philippe, joined the resistance, and they become quite important reformers in the period that stretches between 44 and 46, and they are key advisors to Pierre Mendès France. And yes, I was wondering, who do you think among these two groups of French followers of De Man, who among them sort of really managed to achieve his vision better, to put it into practice more effectively, whether it was those that followed the fascist credo or those that eventually became curiformers in the post-war republic. And the second question instead concerns the Italian followers of the man. So you mentioned Carlo Rosselli, but Carlo Rosselli dies, of course, tragically in 1937. What about the followers of the man in post-war Italy? Honestly, it's quite difficult to find them, but perhaps Riccardo Blombardi could be a candidate. I'm very curious about your opinions on this one. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your fascinating questions. Well, I mean, in terms of success, I would say both supporters of Vichy and supporters of the resistance, in a way, didn't go very far. You can find a lot of interesting individual trajectories, but if one looks at the actual impact, I would say they both experience significant frustrations and disappointments in both camps. Of course, Philippe was perhaps the one who was in the best placed in order to at least try something along the lines proposed by the man in the 30s. And according to some scholars, of course, you can definitely draw some analogies and also some continuities between, for example, what the CGT and the French trade unions were trying to do in the 1930s, building on the man's contributions, and what post-war reformers tried to achieve. Perhaps there is if we move beyond the issue of impact, which I would say is not particularly strong in none of these cases, but if we try to think about someone who, from a kind of anti-fascist resistance and post-war perspective, interestingly and quite originally tried to combine this emphasis on planning on the one end and the strong executive on the other, I would suggest looking at Louis Vallon, who was an interesting character. I've always been quite intrigued by him because he ended up being a Gaullist. And when he explained his personal trajectory, he also emphasized the fact that the type of planning he was interested in had, on the one end, a technocratic dimension, but also had the kind of modernizing aspect that de Gaulle strongly emphasized in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And there is also a fascinating book edited by Gérard Bon, I believe, which brings together the writings on Vallon and some interesting interviews to him. And it is, a fascinating character that could have been studied more extensively, I think. In Italy, well, it's a fascinating, interesting story. Rosselli did a lot in the 1930s, I think, to indirectly bring some of the man's ideas into the Italian public debate. Much of what he wrote in the late 1920s, early 1930s, was definitely and strongly influenced by the man. But in the post-war period, it is also worth remembering the intellectual and political situation of the Italian Socialist Party, which would have been arguably the most obvious setting for a rediscovery of the man ideas. The leader of the party, Nenni, hated the man. There's no other way of putting it, I think. And this was partly related to what the man had done during the war, and partly related to the fact that overall, Nenni had a stronger attachment to Marxism than the man did. There were ideological reasons for this hostility, but there was also, a specific, animosity that had been fueled by the Second World War and by the man's behavior in that. And I certainly do believe that the very strong and powerful position that Nenni held within the Italian Socialist Party was important. There could have been, rediscovery or a deeper study of the man in the Italian Social Democratic Party, the dissidents of right-wing socialists that ended up cooperating with, you know, Christian Democrats. To the best of my knowledge, there was some general, again, awareness and some general knowledge of the man's intellectual contribution, but never a profound and thoroughgoing study until very late in Italy, until very late.
So you would think someone like Roberto Tremelloni would have been a candidate, for example. Okay, thank you.
Sorry, I think, honestly, one of the few, to the best of my knowledge, one of the few intellectuals who repeatedly mentioned the man in the context of the 1980s, for example, was Luciano Pellicani, who also happened to be one of my professors back in the days, who on Mondo Operaio, for example, published a broad overview of the history of socialism, recognizing the importance of the man. But it was quite an exception.
Excellent. I have two final questions I think we have time for in the last 10 minutes or so. The first of them is Pavel Jakubec.
Thank you so much. Thank you all for a thrilling conversation. My question is short, and I'm afraid is a yes or no question. Given his Deman's reflections on the Soviet revolutions, did he register the socialist experiment in the short-lived Republic of Georgia or not? And this is it.
I cannot think of any specific and detailed discussion of this in the man's writings, so I lean towards a no. I must say that, the man's interest and also understanding of Soviet politics was, in a way, I think, very much shaped by contingency. As I said, he had this, first-hand experience and contact also with the Bolsheviks in 1917, who left an enduring negative impression on him. His relationship with Trotsky in particular was awful, and you can read the comments that the two wrote about each other in their respective books and memoirs, and it speaks volume. But of course, he never had a chance, and maybe not even an interest, to develop a systematic and constant survey of developments in the Soviet Union.
The other person who had a question was Talbot Imre.
Sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Tommaso, for the presentation, and also thank you for the copy of the book you sent me. I have a question about the man, and I was piqued by Professor Conway's judgment that the man is essentially a failure. And part of me said, well, most politicians are failures. After all, it's a competitive business, and you never get what you want anyways, even if you get into power. But the man strikes me as a bit, if he's a failure, why are people who are interested in socialism drawn to the man? And I think they are. And it reminds me a bit of Carl Schmitt and how everyone hates Schmitt. He's an awful person, and a bit the man was not a very nice person, not kind of a lovable person, because of what he tells us in a way. And Schmitt, international jurists are drawn to Schmitt because there's something in there, even if they hate the person. And I'm not saying, I'm not equating Schmitt with the man or vice versa, but does not, it seems to me, and I was, so here's my question for Tommaso is, doesn't the man in his various thinking and efforts and contradictions capture all the contradictions within 1930s and perhaps interwar, but I think especially 1930s European socialism? It is very hard at that moment to say what socialism is. What is social democracy? The SFIO, it's tearing itself apart. Blum is heroically trying to keep it together. The SPD in exile is tearing itself apart over these questions. Labor perhaps isn't, because it's got the trade unions and the leadership managed to squash a lot of dissent. But the whole project, in a certain sense, is thrown up in the air, is being ripped apart, and demand those questions about mass democracy, about democracy as a political and effective regime, about the relationship between the state and the economy. All these questions, it seems to me that demand gets at them. He doesn't get the right answers, or he doesn't get the right answers viewed retrospectively from what happens after 1945, but that's a kind of an easy comparison. That's, I would say, an unfair comparison. The question is, what can demand tell us about the 1930s? So that would be my question for Tommaso.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I kind of agree with you. I mean, yes, definitely, especially from a political point of view, of course, the man did not achieve what he hoped and wanted. And perhaps this, suggests us also that part of the problem lies in the fact that he never seemed to have realized that some of the skills, some of the talents, some of the creativity and, intellectual independence that he displayed as a thinker would not translate into assets when going into politics. Also to go back to some of the more recent analogies with figures like Biden and so on that Dina made in her talk. From the point of view of fellow party members, perhaps, the man looked more like John McCain in a sense, a maverick, an independent, someone who never fell in line. Also someone who had a tendency, of course, and that's also important, to look down on people occasionally, reflecting the fact that he had a very sophisticated education. He was fluent in four languages. He had lived in different parts of the world, and he was often working alongside people who were part of the working class, who had started their careers, for example, as miners before joining the unions and then going into parliament and so on and so forth. And this is one of the reasons, of course, why he achieved little. He was not lovable, but also from a social point of view and from a psychological point of view, I would say, he was not particularly well suited to active politics, and especially to the type of active politics that you are bound to perform and practice in a system, in a parliamentary system, and especially in a parliamentary system like Belgium. But you are also correct, I think, in stressing the fact that from an intellectual point of view, this kind of originality, this kind of courage, his tendency to, think out of the box and combine ideas from different origins without caring too much for the kind of ideological continuity made his thought quite interesting and definitely increased his profile as an intellectual. One of the things that struck me, looking back at the debates, the kind of reactions that the man's book also prompted, was this, massive, almost overwhelming concern that very talented and very bright intellectuals within European socialism at the time had for ideological conformity. I mean, take someone like Léon Blum in the 1930s. Extremely well-learned, extremely sophisticated, but also very cautious and very, very persuaded, deeply convinced that ideas are dangerous. Ideas can destroy party. Intellectual renovation, revisionism, if not handled properly, could destroy la vieille maison, the common home, the old house of socialism that he was institutionally bound to protect. And again, here you can find the tension, I believe, between the man, the intellectual, and the man, the politician. From an intellectual point of view, the man could enjoy a degree of freedom and, again, a degree of originality and independence that were absolutely incompatible with the role that he tried to perform later. And part of the difficulties he faced, part of the failure he eventually met, reflected this unresolved tension.
Thank you, Tommaso, for another very rich answer. And I think it's a good note on which to bring proceedings to an end. I think the talk was in itself fascinating, and both discussants added a lot. But for me, at least, it's really been in the discussion that that some of your ideas have sort of come alive most strongly. So I hope we can all agree that it's been a fascinating way to spend an hour and a half this evening. I very much urge you, those of you who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, to get hold of a copy somehow, possibly using the link in the chat, in order to read further. And I very much hope that we can convene again, hopefully in person at some point, and perhaps then adjourn to a pub in that time-honoured fashion, which is no longer possible at the moment. Anyway, thank you very much. Goodbye, and thanks to our three speakers in particular.
Bye.